Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Robert E. Lee's presence as a Confederate commander shape the course of the Civil War, and why did Southern admiration for him continue to grow long after the war was lost? After some early misstarts as a battleground officer in Jefferson Davis's army, Lee found his footing and gained the respect and devotion of his soldiers, even as many marched into certain death in some of the war's most decisive conflicts. But although he accepted the rule of the U.S. federal government after his surrender at Appomattox, the defeat left Lee bitter and depressed for the remainder of his life. Mark Zwanitzer is producer of the American Experience documentary Robert E. Lee, which debuts tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13 television. Mark, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Such an interesting background that Robert E. Lee had. His father had been a Revolutionary War hero, Light Horse Harry. But by the time Robert E. Lee came along, Light Horse Harry had pretty much disgraced the family name.
Yeah, he was a wonderful military man and a lousy businessman. And he had lost a lot of money, and he had written bad checks to people like George Washington. He had essentially lost the family estate. I mean, he had a couple of fathers-in-law, and one of them made sure that he had nothing to do with the will. So by the time Robert E. Lee came around, his father's name was a bit of a disgrace. At the same time, the flip side of that coin is when Robert E. Lee was a very young boy and Lafayette made his famous trip back to the United States, one of the things he did was go to see the Lee family, and it's so Light Horse Harry left behind a legacy for good and ill.
Was it always expected that Robert E. Lee would be a soldier?
Oddly, it's one of the things that happened is because Harry lost all the money in the family, he didn't have the choice, like one of his older brothers, to go away to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually something of an economic necessity that he go to West Point that was going to be a free education. At the same time, he was always very interested in things military and things martial, and he was happy to be at West Point once he got there.
And he was an exceptionally good student.
He was an exceptionally good student and an exceptionally devoted student. I mean, he didn't let anything slip. And he was very, very serious about his work at school and wanted to make sure everybody knew that. He was he always wanted to be the number one cadet at West Point.
So he won that rank. It didn't win him a lot of friends, it sounds like.
Well, he actually didn't quite win it. He graduated number two, as a matter of fact. While he had plenty of friends and comrades, everybody knew that Lee was a bit of a grind and maybe a little bit over the top.
He was gifted in his studies in just the area that the country needed at the time. He was essentially a civil engineer for the U.S. military.
Right, and he was a very good civil engineer. He was shipped all over the country on building projects, including one remarkable thing he did outside of St. Louis, where he actually sort of changed the course of the Mississippi River and made sure the downtown St. Louis wasn't underwater. When there was a big job to be done, they knew that they could count on Lee as an engineer.
So this sounds like someone who would have been considered a good catch in his day, especially among Southern women. But Mary Custis's father did not think the two should marry.
Well, no. I mean, he knew the tales of Light Horse Harry were at large in the land, and one of Lee's brothers had been disgraced in even worse ways. And so Lee was not actually much of a catch. He didn't come with an estate. And while he was from a good family, it was something of a disgraced family at that point.
So how did he finally win over his father-in-law, his would-be father-in-law?
Well, I think actually he did it the way any smart man would do, which was he won over his would-be mother-in-law first.
Well, and he was very good-looking.
He was extremely attractive. I mean, there were women who said he was the best-looking man in the United States Army. And he was very serious about his appearance. You know, he was quite proud of that distinction and took care to make sure that he remained one of the most attractive men in the United States Army.
What sort of match as a couple did Mary Custis and Robert E. Lee make?
Well, they were a little bit at odds in the sense that Lee was a perfectionist. Lee was an engineer, a very logical-minded man, a man who liked things in order and in place. And Mary was a bit of a walking tornado. Nothing was ever quite in place, and she lived by her own. She was something of a free spirit, as the great writer Elizabeth Brown Pryor mentioned in the show. And so it was not easy always for them to be together. At the same time, I think there was a great, it was actually pretty. If you read their letters, it was a wonderful romance, and they cared deeply for one another.
And maybe it held their marriage together that he wasn't home a lot.
I think it must have made it a lot easier for him, certainly. And he always was very serious about his doing his duty and being out on the job. And so Mary's calls for him to come home were generally fell on deaf ears.
Yeah, he was furious when she said, come home and spend some time with me.
At a couple of points, yeah, he really, how can you ask me to be derelict in my duty, was essentially what he said to her, when she was going through a very difficult pregnancy and could have used him at home. Now, at the same time, she was, Mary was not well. She was often unhealthy, and he was a good husband to her, and when she was unwell, he did make sure to be home and he essentially nursed her through a lot of illness.
I guess one of the scholars in the documentary talks about mercury poisoning. Where would that have come from?
It was she had pain and arthritis, mm-hmm. and I think they were giving her drugs that were laced with mercury. I don't think that was an uncommon thing at that time. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about this. We think of him as such a warrior, but in fact, he spent the first two decades of his military career and saw no battlefield action at all.
Yeah, well, there really was not much going on. I mean, aside from skirmishes, in the Cherokee Nation in the 1830s, not a lot happened in his career until the Mexican-American War, and that was 20 years into his career. So he was really a frustrated warrior with no war. And the promotions were few and far between. The pay was not so good. The living conditions were not so good. I mean, there were times where he talked constantly about, bailing out of the United States Army.
But then in 1846, the U.S.-Mexican War breaks out, and it's like the thing he's been waiting for.
This is the moment, and he knew. I mean, he wasn't altogether sure about the politics of the war, but he knew this was his chance to show the soldier he could be, the thing he'd been trained to do. And he was spectacular. He was he really stood out in that war.
Not just brave in this war, but incredibly clever. He essentially found a way to lead U.S. troops through what was believed to be unpassable territory.
Yeah, Winfield Scott used Lee as kind of his eyes and ears out in the field, and Lee was constantly out front of the army, scouting for ways around the Mexican army, scouting for ways, to flank certain towns and strongholds. And Winfield Scott, put a lot of confidence in Robert E. Lee, invested a lot of confidence in him, and Lee did not disappoint him.
So they had a strong relationship. What sort of relationship, if any, was there between Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant, who they were fighting on the same side in the U.S.-Mexican War?
Almost none. And in fact, Lee, at the time of the surrender, said he didn't even remember Grant, mm-hmm. which may have been an intentional shot and may have been absolutely true. Lee was with McClellan a little bit during that war. They were both renowned. They were both decorated coming out of that war, but they didn't really. And Grant was a good bit younger.
Mm-hmm. So the Mexican War ends in 1848, and at this point, Lee figures maybe all his glory days are over.
Yeah, and not only that, but he was very much recognized in that war by people like Winfield Scott in after-battle reports and things like that. But he was a little chagrined that in the newspapers there were a lot of other people getting a lot of credit that he didn't think maybe was altogether deserved. So he was sort of frustrated by the aftermath of the, of that war, and again was not sure he wanted to stick it out in the U.S. Army.
So around this time, Mark, it seems that Lee had a pretty profound religious awakening. Can you talk about what caused that and how it affected him?
Yeah, well, from the time he began courting Mary, his wife was really after him. She was a what we would describe probably as a born-again Christian now, very serious about Christianity, and Lee was not. And Lee never really was a religious person. And it was after his mother-in-law died, to whom he was very close, that he sort of grabbed a hold of religion and of Mary's religion. And I think that there were a few things going on. I mean, he was getting older. He was losing people he was close to. He was sort of looking for meaning and purpose. And the meaning and purpose of his life had always been the United States Army, and things weren't quite so solid there. I can't say exactly why he grabbed onto religion like he did, but it wasn't a big part of his life until he was nearly 50 years old, and then it became central.
How did that faith play into his understanding of slavery? He essentially saw it as a kind of a necessary evil. Is that accurate?
Well, Lee basically believed, he's an engineer, and B, he had a deep conviction that there was a God ordering the world. Mm-hmm. And, the way he saw things, God had ordered this world, and if God had a better plan, he would in time reveal it. And he wrote very specifically about that. Lee was very uncomfortable with slavery and spent his whole life sort of trying to get away from having to deal with slaves, but when his father-in-law died, he was thrust into the role of taking care of the plantations and overseeing something very near 100 slaves. He was not much for the institution of slavery, but he didn't see anything to replace it. He also would write, and he wrote to Mary at one point and to other people, that basically slavery was much more difficult on the white man and the master than it was on the slave.
And we should say, I mean, this sounds so awful, but there were many people in his set that would have believed similarly. Is that right?
I think most people in his set probably did believe similarly, that this was sort of God's plan this is the way the world was. I don't think he questioned it much. I mean, I know he didn't question it much.
When the Civil War began, though, he did not feel that his primary purpose was defending slavery, or was it at that point all sort of wrapped up in the whole thing for him?
I don't think he would see his primary purpose as defending slavery. I think he'd see his primary purpose as defending Virginia, his state of Virginia, the idea of Virginia, and the Confederate States as well. I don't think that he went to war defending slavery, but I'm sure he went to war happy to get a chance to bloody the nose of the abolitionists.
Mm-hmm. Producer Mark Zwanitzer is my guest. He created the new American Experience documentary, Robert E. Lee, which airs tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13 Television. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Mark Zwanitzer. He produced the new American Experience documentary, Robert E. Lee, that will air tonight at 8 on KERA 13 television. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Mark, am I correct that Lee was not enthusiastic for Virginia to secede from the Union?
I think Lee understood what secession was going to mean. Mm-hmm. I mean, he said before South Carolina seceded even, that this was going to mean a long and bloody war. So he knew the consequences were huge, and for that reason, he was not at all anxious to be caught up in a war of this sort of magnitude. I mean, he knew it was. He said it could be 10 years and very bloody.
And of course, it's hard to even imagine this now because we so associate him with the Confederacy. But in fact, at the very start of things, he was invited by Abraham Lincoln to take command of Union forces.
He was invited to take command of an army that was defending Washington, and probably, you know, his career trajectory would have meant he would have been the commander of all Union forces at some point. Lincoln, you can understand politically, very much wanted officers from Virginia in high posts in the Union Army. About 40% of the U.S. Army officers from Virginia stayed in the Union, and it was important to have, you know, those people as symbols in the Union Army. And Lee, of course, being known as one of the best soldiers in the U.S. Army and known to Winfield Scott, was offered a plum, and it was not easy for him to turn it down.
And he talked to Scott about his consternation over this.
Yeah, he really did. And at one point he said, you know, he might just go and sit out the war, and Scott was quite angry about it. I mean, there are other things, you know, that are not in the film for time reasons, but for instance, Lee's son was also in the Union Army at that point in time. And even after Lee had made his decision to leave the United States Army and to go into command in the Confederate Army, he was writing his son saying, you know, you make your own decision. If it's right for you to stay with the Union, you do that. And he wasn't going to influence him. I should say he was writing his daughter to tell his son that. He was certainly conflicted.
Did Lincoln take his refusal to serve in the Union Army personally?
I don't think at first Lincoln did, but there was a time later. In fact, when Lincoln famously suspended the writ of habeas corpus, he actually named Lee and a couple of other former Union officers by name, you know, saying, if I'd known then what I know now, I would have had him arrested in Washington.
So we think of Lee leading these huge charges of soldiers later in the war, but he sort of floundered in the beginning. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, he had he went out into Western Virginia in a couple of campaigns and really didn't do very well, and was quite a disappointment. In fact, he was known in some quarters as Granny Lee, and he was just, they thought he was always playing defense and never moving forward, and he really, in the first year of the war, was not a happy time for him.
And then another general was shot off his horse, and Jefferson Davis needed to put someone in that spot.
Yeah, as George McClellan was driving toward Richmond, General Johnston was shot down, and Davis actually made the appointment, temporary appointment, for Lee. There were people at the time of that appointment who were quite disappointed with that.
So they thought this guy that we've known as Granny Lee is not going to do us any favors.
Yeah. No, I mean, that wasn't universal, but mm-hmm. It was widespread at that point in time. He quickly turned around that reputation in about 3 days.
Do you think that his sort of change in strategy and his very aggressive tactics had to do with the fact that he had been criticized before for being too much on the defense?
No, I think actually that it was a question of circumstances. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the army, and he didn't really have the circumstances that would have given him a chance for a strong, aggressive attack in Western Virginia. So I think he learned in the Mexican War that attack was what won you battles, and he was not that interested in playing defense. So what it was, the seven days, and when he took over outside of Richmond, it was sort of the opportunity finding the man at that point.
And the 7 days are just this incredibly bloody time. Was it 36,000 dead by the time that was over?
I don't remember the number offhand, but it was a lot of people, a lot of people killed and wounded in that battle.
How much of a problem was it people deserting because they were afraid they were going to be killed?
Well, I think that's true in any and both armies, and especially for armies who were fighting on their own home ground, you know, where it's a little easier to get away. But that being said, the Army of Northern Virginia was a remarkable fighting force, and the desertions really were not a problem until late in the war.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Mark Zwanitzer, who produced the American Experience documentary Robert E. Lee, which airs tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13 Television. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. This is so fascinating to me because I've wondered this for years. His emotional and sort of ideological choice that he faced, you know, in the face of slavery, which was an obvious moral dilemma at the time, his behavior is nothing to be proud of. And it seems to me, in a discussion of his legacy, you have to view him as a tragic figure, like in the Shakespearean vein, you know, like Nixon. And it's his flawed humanity that we should remember. You know, why does history give this man a pass? Why is he lionized? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think the reason he was lionized coming out of the war were political. I mean, the South needed a symbol, and he was a very good symbol to have. I think Henry Adams once famously said of him, "It's, you know, it's the good men you have to be worried about. They can do the most damage." And you have to be frank that Lee was. You know, he made his choice, and he fought on the side of the Confederacy, which was on the side of slavery. And I would say I don't think Lee is a tragic figure in that, you know, he made his own choices. He's a sad figure at the end because, he lost everything. But I wouldn't call him tragic in the sense that... you know, he wasn't put in an impossible position. He made his own choice and lived with the consequences.
It's pretty amazing the accounts that exist in the documentary about his sort of personal strength and his commitment to duty. At one point, he has a massive heart attack and yet sort of gets up a couple of days later and keeps fighting.
Well, this is one of the most fascinating things to me about Lee is he was so physically capable. And he was so tough, and he had so much stamina. And there's a great upside to that, you know. It makes you a remarkable soldier. At the same time, there's a downside. You tend to go a little bit too far. And he never was able to really understand why other people weren't able to go as far as he did. He was very tough on his subordinates. He was very tough on the soldiers. Who served under him. It was not an easy thing to serve for Lee because he demanded and expected as much of his subordinates and his soldiers as he did of himself.
And I guess subordinates would write about having to monitor and look at the veins in his neck or something to see if he was about to snap.
Yeah, snapping at his ear, they called it. He could be, I mean, you can understand he was in a tough position and he could lash out and be quite angry at people who were nearest him.
It's interesting, too, that he was aware of this. It wasn't something that he didn't really apologize for it, but he also wasn't unaware that he made people miserable around him.
No, I mean, he was a man who didn't apologize. You know, he didn't say he was sorry directly, but he was one of those people, and we probably all know them, who would you know, come up and have a friendly pat on the back and a discussion with someone he'd been so difficult to. It was his way of saying I'm sorry without ever admitting that he'd been wrong. So he knew. I mean, he understood, and he was, I don't want to say he was unsympathetic to the people around him. He was just quite demanding.
And during the Civil War, he himself, all kinds of terrible things were happening back home. People were dying and getting very sick, and he persevered.
Yeah, I mean, he lost his only two grandchildren died during the war. He lost a daughter. He lost a daughter-in-law. One of his sons was captured and a prisoner of war. And he never let it, he never let it knock him off the beam. You know, he was there to do his duty, and he wasn't going to let personal stuff get in the way.
Did he suffer from not letting the facts of being hugely outnumbered and out-equipped get in the way of the battles that he planned and the attacks that he planned?
Well, he had remarkable confidence in his own, in the ability of the Army of Northern Virginia. And, you know, I would suggest that when he won that remarkable, surprising, and unexpected victory at Chancellorsville, and he was marching toward what would become Gettysburg, he really thought his army could not lose at that point. There was just a little bit of hubris that got him into trouble.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking about the new documentary, Robert E. Lee. It's an American Experience program that airs tonight at 8 on KERA 13 television. You can also get to us via email. That goes to think@kera.org. We'll go to the phones now, though, and speak with Stephen in Dallas. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Really want to thank you for taking the call and wonderful guest.
Super. Welcome.
Thank you.
Did you want to say something?
Well, I have a question, or just if your guest has any information on this, that during and following the Mexican-American War, that Lee served a fair time in Texas, particularly in the Hill Country at Fort Mason and down in San Antonio, and I was wondering if he might have any comments or information on that.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, actually, Lee had two different stints down in Texas, in the second one, it was right before the war broke out, this is not in the film, but it's not out of the realm of possibility that had the war broken out down in Texas, that Robert E. Lee would have been the Union officer defending one of the most important military installations, which he would have defended to the death down there at that point in time. This was sort of right before Virginia seceded. So, yes, he did spend a couple of tours down in Texas, and if history had been a little bit different, then odd things would have happened there.
I'm guessing the historians that you interviewed for the film don't like to speculate on this, but I'm wondering if it's something that you gave any thought to just as you were putting this together, how different the course of the war might have been had Lee been fighting on the side of the Union.
If he had brought the same sense of mission, the same sense of ability, I think the war probably would have been over quite a bit earlier. And the reason I say this, and it is complete speculation, but remember McClellan, really the Union commander early in the war, George McClellan, was really essentially already trying to find ways to run for president at that point. He was not pushing the Union army in the way it should have been pushed. Lincoln was not happy about that. If you put Lee in that position, This war might have been a 10-month war or something. But you know what? That's total speculation. I'm no expert, and I don't know.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go to John in Fort Worth now. Hi, John.
Hi, and I appreciate this show, and I appreciate your guest. And I just wanted to share that apparently he said that Lee was promoted when General Johnston was killed in the Battle of Shiloh. And for anybody here in Texas, if you go to the Texas State Cemetery in Austin, General Albert Sidney Johnston is buried there.
No, and actually, it was Joseph Johnston.
Oh, Joseph
killed
Johnston.
Outside Rich. Joseph Johnston killed okay. outside Richmond. No, it's a, that's two different people, and I didn't say the Battle of Shiloh. No, Joseph Johnston was killed outside Richmond, and Lee took over for him right before 7 days.
Talk about this for a minute, Mark. When you're deciding who you want to feature in a program like this, what goes through your head in terms of who will be the best story and where you can find the most information? What made you decide on Robert E. Lee?
Well, American Experience had done a Ulysses S. Grant program a few years back and had always wanted to do a Lee. And so that was it had been a program that had been in the hopper for a long time. Lee's a much more difficult person to come at than Ulysses S. Grant, and I think that gave everybody pause. But it turned out, he is a fascinating, interesting, conflicted, and important character in American history, whether you are for him or against him, and I'm glad I got to spend some time learning about him.
And what made him so challenging was the fact that he was fighting for the Confederacy?
Well, what made him so challenging in part was that there is a big myth that's grown up around Robert E. Lee, and I wasn't really interested in parsing the myth and breaking it down. I was interested in trying to find out, who this guy was at the center of his person. There's just a lot of stuff already been written and said about him that's hard to wade through.
Filmmaker Mark Zwanitzer is my guest. He produced the American Experience documentary Robert E. Lee, which airs tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13 television. We'll come back for the final segment of our program in just a couple of minutes. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Mark Zwanitzer, producer of the American Experience documentary Robert E. Lee, which airs tonight nationwide and at 8 p.m. on KERA 13 television here in Dallas and Fort Worth. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So toward the end of the war, Lee was sleeping 2 hours a night. He had lost several key commanders to wounding or death. But it was not until Lincoln was reelected that it occurred to him that the war might very well be lost for the South.
I think what he said literally was that after Lincoln was reelected was, prepare yourself, we should prepare ourselves for 10 more years of war. I don't think he was ready to give up. I think he said it was going to get more and more difficult. Lee was not going to stop. He didn't see it as his place, he wasn't Jefferson Davis. But as long as the war was on, he was going to fight. That was a soldier's duty.
How did it finally happen that he surrendered at Appomattox in 1865?
Well, I think he recognized they were basically living in trenches. It was trench warfare a la World War I, probably not quite so bad, but close to it. And he was seeing his army just sort of melting away. They were literally starving. They didn't have food. Men at this point were starting to desert and to run. And I think he figured, it was not his final decision, but I think he understood to continue would be suicide.
Why wasn't he hanged as a traitor after the war?
Well, I guess you'd have to ask Lincoln about that, but I think that...
Was it a PR move?
I think it was very much a political move and a wise one. Mm-hmm. That, this was not a time for reprisal, and I think that Lincoln and Grant were very clear about how they wanted to end this war.
Do you sense that having had his life spared played into Lee's, at least public support for obeying the U.S. federal government and bringing the country back together after the war was over?
No, I don't think it was a sense that he'd been spared somehow. I mean, I think that he actually thought it was the right thing to do. I mean, if you are defeated in war, you it's your obligation. It's all speculation about that, but I think that I wouldn't suggest that having been spared really figured much into that for him.
So late in his life, he said that perhaps the greatest mistake of his life had been going to West Point and taking a military education and committing his life to military service. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it did surprise me, but when I first read it, but if you think back on, I mean, if you look where he was at that point in his life, I mean, the society he had known had been destroyed. His family was really in terrible shape. You look at those pictures of Richmond after the war, as the city destroyed, the cost on him, the cost on his family was enormous. And but that's what, you know, he lived his life the way a soldier should live it, and that was the those were the costs.
Even the fact that none of his daughters would ever marry, in part because an entire generation of young men had been killed.
Yeah, his daughters never did marry, and it's hard to imagine the level of the amount of devastation done on both sides, but particularly in the South, and most particularly in Virginia, which was such a huge part of the battlefield.
So what was his life like after the war? He went and was the president of a college?
He was president of what is now Washington and Lee College. I think he wanted to sort of retreat, stay away from politics. I think he wanted to live in quiet. I don't think he wanted to relive the war in any sense. He wrote a letter about going out. He would go out and on long rides with Traveler, and he would confide in Traveler because he knew that Traveler wasn't going to talk to anybody else.
And it really wasn't until after he died that all those dozens, if not hundreds, of monuments started springing up throughout the South. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. In fact, at the time of his death, there are letters that I found that I didn't know about, that Mary and some other people were writing back and forth trying to raise money for monuments for Lee, and it wasn't actually as easy as you might have imagined in 1870.
And was that important to him?
I think that he would not be pleased with what he had been turned into, which was the marble man, the marble myth we all know about. I think that he was not a political being. He was a soldier, and he wanted to be known for doing great and glorious things on the battlefield.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Bernie in Richardson. Hi, Bernie.
Good afternoon.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, neither Lee nor any of the Southerners were regarded as traitors because the North saw them simply as members of the family that went astray and then they were brought back in. But my real point was going to be that the reason Lee became a marble figure was because every side during the war needs a single individual that we can put all our hopes and trust in. And on the North, that was obviously Lincoln. And in the South, Jefferson Davis did not fill that bill, and they needed someone that they could put all their hopes and trust and ambitions in, and that turned out to be Lee. You can make a comment on that if you'd like.
Thanks.
Yeah, actually, that's a very astute observation, Bernie, and you're quite right about that. And during the war, people's hopes in the South were really tied up in Lee and in the Army of Northern Virginia. He was the symbol of that war effort. There's no question about that, and I think he was proud and pleased to be that symbol. I'm not sure that the same could be said that he would be so interested in being a political symbol in the years after the war. But you're quite right, and very astute.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go back to the phones now. This time, speak with Renee in Dallas. Hi, Renee.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
As you probably know, the Mexican War was the training ground for many of the generals during the Civil that later fought in the Civil War. Was General Lee involved? I've heard that he was either involved or led the attack at the Battle of Chapultepec, which is a very famous battle in Mexico City. Is that true or false?
Well, he didn't so much lead those battles as he was. He wasn't really leading soldiers in that war. What he was doing was, again, he was out front. He was scouting. He was scouting for, you know, places for artillery locations and ways into cities. And I mean, he was the guy. He was a key to the planning of those battles. He was also. He was up and in the saddle heading into Mexico City for like something like 48 hours and had some slight wound and had to be taken off his horse. So he wasn't leading men in battle as much as he was acting as a scout, a planner, a person on Winfield Scott's kitchen cabinet, essentially his staff.
Did Lee do a lot of writing at the end of his life trying to summarize or make sense of his military career?
He played around with a memoir, but what that memoir was about was really the story of the Army of Northern Virginia. He didn't really have that much interest in aggrandizing Robert E. Lee. I think he did have a good bit of interest in telling the story of the Army of Northern Virginia, which he was hugely attached to.
We've talked a lot about how he loved his wife but was gone a lot, and he was very committed to duty. What was he like as a father?
There were a couple different things. One is that he was, his kids loved him, and he was a very physical father. He liked to be with them, and there were a lot of tickle fests, and he was, especially when they were younger, a very physical presence with them. And as they got older and he was away more and more, he fathered through his letters. And the letters to his children are very fascinating. And they tend to give, prescriptions and proscriptions for living, how you should conduct yourself and what's the right way to be a gentleman and what's the right way to be a lady. And there was a lot of advice. And it's clear that he thought they had something big to live up to, and he expected big things of them. So while he wasn't always present physically, he was a very big and important presence in their lives.
Did you sense that he had the same sort of conflict that today's soldiers who are mothers and fathers deal with, which is trying to be aware of the day-to-day realities of life while also trying to fight this war? Or was he writing to them about sort of always do this or that, as opposed to your mother told me last Wednesday you did this, this, and this?
Well, there was a little bit of both of that, a little bit of that also. But the other thing that fascinated me was there were, when he first went to Mexico, before the fighting began, but he was first down there, and you can feel he was just alive to the world, He was excited to be there, and he was writing back to his daughter these beautiful descriptions of the flora and fauna in Mexico and what it looked like and what it smelled like, and it was almost poetic, some of the descriptions of this world that he was in, and he wanted to share that with his children. I found that fascinating and interesting and unexpected.
Is it possible when you study a figure like this so closely as to make a film about his life, can you sort of come away with being comfortable with the parts you really like about him and also recognizing there are things about him that you can't embrace?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty common with any figure, you know. But he was a more difficult one to reconcile. I mean, I think he had big, huge, amazing talents and strengths and abilities, and it all went badly. As a friend of mine said in from New Jersey, he likes to say, "It worked out. It just didn't work out so good."
Do you find that when you speak to scholars, does geography these days have anything to do with how they perceive Robert E. Lee or what they imagine his overall role was in the Civil War?
You know, what I would say is that the kind of split, the North-South split, while still there in the wider population, in the world of academics and in the world of people who make study, there's not so much widespread difference. That the Robert E. Lee, the myth of the marble man, as I have said, is sort of aging out, and
yeah.
And so there's, you know, there's not as many people who are the adherents to the old Douglas Southall Freeman mythology of Lee.
Another thing I want to ask you about is how do you comb through photographs and letters and pictures and decide what images you're going to use in a film like this?
Well, let me tell you something that surprised me about the Lee images is that, you know, there are huge amounts of images of the of Union armies.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very, very few images of the Army of Northern Virginia. And so we were limited in what we could do in terms of the archival photographs.
Were you able to figure out why?
Well, I think there were just it was tougher to be a photographer with the Confederate Army, with the Army of Northern Virginia, and I think that so that's a big reason why. I'm sure a lot of things were destroyed in Richmond, and so the photographic record is not very strong, and it was a really difficult task, this film, because of that.
I will say, and we're about to wrap up here, but I love the use of pen and ink drawings that, from wartime correspondents. They were great in the film. Well,
weren't they great? And
yeah.
What we did was we didn't use the finished products in many instances. We used what they did actually on the battlefield. There's a certain amount of urgency to those
Absolutely.
Sketches because of that.
Mark Zwanitzer is the producer of the American Experience documentary Robert E. Lee. It debuts tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13 television. Mark, thank you so much for giving us this hour.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.